This is Marine Sergeant Roy Johnson of the Base Information Services Office, Marine Corps Base, Camp Lejeune, speaking to Major Edward Chester Tipsius of the 10th Marine Regimental Headquarters, 2nd Marine Division, Camp Lejeune. Today's date is 12th day of January 1966. Major Tipsius was assigned as an assistant advisor, Rungsat Special Zone for 10 months, and an artillery battalion advisor with the 2nd Vietnamese Infantry Division during his tour in the Republic of Vietnam. The classification of this tape is
secret.
Major Tipsius, sir, what organization are you with here at Camp Lejeune?
Headquarters Battery, 2nd Battalion, 10th Marines, 2nd Marine Division.
When did you leave for Vietnam?
Well, I initially departed for a tour overseas of 3rd Marine Division. I left this, I left continental United States, I believe it was about the 30th of August, 1964. And I arrived in Okinawa about the 1st or 2nd of September, 64, where I was assigned to 1st Battalion, 12th Marines for normal tour duty, 13 months overseas. I was there for about 3 to 4 weeks when I suddenly was alerted that I was on 12-hour standby to go to Vietnam. And they also informed me at the time that this was going to be a permanent change of station from Okinawa to Vietnam, and I was going to be acting as an advisor, an artillery battalion advisor in the First Corps area. At this time, Commanding General of FMF Pacific had made an arrangement with I believe it was General Westmoreland, who was commander of the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, to put in 60 United States Marine Corps advisors in the First Corps area, which encompasses the 5 northern provinces of South Vietnam. And they would all go there as battalion advisors, either infantry or artillery. So I went over there. Well, we were on 12-hour standby, and eventually we went over in 3 increments. I believe there were 24 officers and 36 enlisted men that were sent over, and I was in the 3rd increment, of which there were, I believe, 10 or 12 officers. We were the last group to go over, and I departed Okinawa from Kadena Air Force Base on the 12th of October 1964 and arrived at Da Nang, South Vietnam, on the same date, 12 October 64. And we were greeted there by a First Corps representative who then told us that we would be going on down to Saigon to attend a 2 weeks concentrated course in a MATA course, M-A-T-A, which stood for Military Assistance Training Advisor. They have the equivalent course here in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, that I think runs 8 or 10 weeks, but they set up something for the people that were coming out there without this school. So we waited 2 days. We spent 2 nights at Da Nang, living in the Da Nang Hilton, they call it there. It was with the Marine helicopter squadron that was deployed there at the Da Nang airstrip had set up. There were squad-type tents with cots in there and mosquito netting and such. I remember the first night very well because I really got chewed up by the mosquitoes. They didn't seem to be apparent in the daytime, but at the night, it was quite apparent. Well, 2 days later, we got on another aircraft, a C-123, and flew on down to Saigon, where nobody was there to meet us. And we arranged ourselves some transportation to go into Military Assistance Command Vietnam headquarters in Saigon and looked around, made a few telephone calls, and got ourselves coordinated with the people there. And we started attending schools. We were billeted in the Majestic Hotel on the Saigon River there. There were four to a room, and it was also a civilian hotel, but they did contract with the U.S. government, so there were quite a few U.S. temporary type individuals living there. I was a captain at this time. All the other officers were either company grade with one Johnny Walker was his name, who was just had made major. I've got a roster of those people now, if you so desire.
We'll go back to that a little bit later, sir.
Okay, so we attended this military assistance training advisor course. It lasted 2 weeks, which was fairly comprehensive. It covered such things as ambushing, things like that, how to get along with your Vietnamese counterpart, and general background information on the country and things of that sort. And after we completed that, we had our orders and we all flew back up north to Da Nang. And we arrived there, I think it was the end of October, where we then were assigned out to the various areas. Now, I was assigned as an advisor, artillery battalion advisor to the 2nd Vietnamese Artillery Battalion of the 2nd Vietnamese Infantry Division of 1st Corps, whose headquarters were in Da Nang.
Who was your commanding officer of this organization, sir? Do you remember that?
The Vietnamese?
Yes, sir.
It was Captain Na, N-G-H-A, Vietnamese Captain Na. And I relieved the Captain Bear, U.S. Army, and I was the advisor for this battalion. Now, this artillery battalion, they had just changed their organization so that they had 6-gun batteries, 3 batteries of 6 guns each, plus a small headquarters battery. And the headquarters of the battalion was located just on the outskirts of Da Nang, beyond the airstrip, I think where the Marines are, could probably extend their outer perimeter right now. And this is where the headquarters were located.
How many men, sir, were in your advisory group?
Well, they had the 1st Corps advisory team, which I don't know how many men. It was commanded by a colonel. It's a U.S. Army colonel. But all these, our advisors were all U.S. Army, with the exception of these 60 Marines. And I don't know how many there were. There was quite a few. There was an organized compound there. Well, we had an office and a couple other small offices and a supply system there at 1st Corps headquarters. 1st Corps headquarters was also located in Da Nang. Now, there were all these other advisors. They were out in various other places, such as Wei and places up north and Quang Nai. This all came under 1st Corps, so there was quite a few. I have no idea.
And what was your specific job there, sir?
I advised the 2nd Artillery Battalion advisor in artillery matters.
And he was Vietnamese?
And he was Vietnamese, yes.
Was there a language barrier, sir?
Not much of a language barrier, because most of your Vietnamese Army artillery officers had attended Fort Sill here back in the United States, so most of them could speak English. There were a few that couldn't. They didn't speak it perfectly well, but they spoke it enough to where you could get along. There were problems. Sometimes you had to state yourself 2 and 3 times, and then sometimes they very conveniently made the language barrier when they just didn't want to go along with some of the things you wanted to advise them on. This was the problem we ran into throughout.
What was the mission of this battalion, sir?
The mission of the 2nd Artillery Battalion was to support various infantry units that were located throughout the 1st Corps area, generally from around the Da Nang area on south to Quang Nai, the city of Quang Nai, which was about, 100 miles south. roughly. Maybe 75 to 100 miles south. Now, roughly, this artillery battalion, although it might have had a paper organization similar to our organization, in fact, they were employed quite differently. They employed all their artillery in two-gun platoons. So what you amounted to having was 9 two-gun platoons, each platoon having their own little fire direction section and the lieutenant usually commanding, and they were emplaced fairly permanently throughout the southern portion of the First Corps area, and I had about 75 to 100 miles between one platoon and another platoon. The mobility, you just didn't have any land mobility in the area because the roads were cut and too prone to ambush by the Viet Cong. So whenever you moved an artillery platoon, you had to move it by helicopter or by C-123.
And what's C-123, sir?
A C-123 is a U.S. Air Force cargo aircraft.
Seven and a half.
It's a little bit difficult to visualize how the artillery was employed up there, but think of it as this way. As the artillery battalion commander did not command an artillery battalion in our sense of the word. What he did was he had 9 artillery platoons distributed throughout the southern portion of First Corps, whose platoons were really attached to various Vietnamese infantry units and came under Vietnamese infantry control, so he had nothing really to say on just exactly where they went and how they were employed and how they were positioned, at the exact spot of where they were positioned. And he was just more or less required to administratively support these platoons and to make sure that they had their ammunition up and to inspect them from time to time to see that what positions they had prepared were good and that their troops were trained and that they could shoot the artillery. But he did not have any control over the actual employment of the artillery, not in any sense of the word like we would keep under battery control and would mass our batteries for all the various principles of war, of surprise and mass and mobility that we think of in our employment of artillery. It was quite a different thing. And in fact, as an advisor, what I would endeavor to do would be to try and get the Vietnamese battalion commander out to get a helicopter schedule. We had to use Vietnamese helicopters. They were U.S. CH-34 type helicopters, the old CH-34. And they were Vietnamese marked, and we had Vietnamese pilots, Air Force pilots, that would fly them. We'd attempt to get a ride on one of these in one of our platoon positions. Well, we'd stay a day or two and inspect it, see how they fired, and check to see if they're well-trained and they could shoot these two artillery pieces. It was a problem in itself to get Vietnamese helicopter support because the Vietnamese helicopters up there, they never flew at night. The pilots were poor. They were strictly the type of pilots that would fly visual only. They wouldn't do any night or any instrument flying if they could help it, and they were reckless. And I always, from my short experience at the flights I had, you're putting your life in the hands of a very inexperienced and I sometimes thought immature individual, and I think that we damn near crashed 3 times because of the way these Vietnamese helicopter pilots flew. But we'd get a couple of times they just refused to fly because they didn't like the sound of the engine and they'd walk off, and nobody would force them to take the aircraft up. One time we'd go out to the airstrip and we'd sit in this aircraft and they'd rev the engines up and they'd take off on a running takeoff, and they'd go up in the air and they'd circle around and they'd set down on a running type landing. They wouldn't set their choppers down the way we do. They'd come in and just land almost like a regular fighter aircraft, only they wouldn't use as much runway. and they'd say something was wrong. They didn't like the way it sounded. And this would take an entire morning to get up sometimes. Well, finally, we'd get a couple, and they'd always fly in pairs. So we'd get off. If I could explain one trip that we took down to Quang Nai province, we finally got off the following day after another pilot went in there and decided to fly, and we flew down to Quang Nai. At this time, it was the month of November 64, and it was in the rainy season, very bad, just before this hurricane hit up there in that period of time. And we were flying down to Quang Nai, and we got there all right. And we landed, we got some transportation, and we got into the town and went out to the Vietnamese infantry battalion position that was on the edge of town. And there was also U.S. advisory compound out there, which I went to, threw off my gear. And then we tried to get a helicopter to go out to, I think it was Duc Pho, which was about another 50 miles south of where Quang Nai was, which was still in the First Corps area, where we had a platoon that we wanted to look at. And we couldn't get any helicopters. And we spent 3 days down there, and the helicopters that came down, we couldn't get the Vietnamese use these helicopters for something else. So all we did was do some talking, and we ended up getting a ride back in a C-123, and I had to talk to the U.S. Air Force pilot to get the Vietnamese on. And then we flew back to Da Nang, and this was just before the enormous floods around First Corps. Then later on, next week, we got another helicopter ride down there, and this time we got a helicopter ride to Duc Pho. The helicopters were flying at, I would say, altitudes right down Highway 1 from Quang Nai down south at about 50-foot altitude. Now, this is not too good an idea in the open terrain that we had there, because this was all VC country that we're flying over. And it wasn't too long, I'd say 20 minutes, we raised our altitude up a little bit to about 1,000 feet, and we started getting shot at. And both helicopters were hit a little bit, but we continued on. We flew on back to Quang Nai. They aborted the mission of going down because the Vietnamese pilots just didn't like being shot at. We got back, and there were a couple of bullet holes in each aircraft, and also a nice little piece of, I'd say a 4-inch by 4-inch section of the rotor blade of the other chopper was gone because they said it was by ground fire, but upon examining it, I noticed that there was wood stuffed in there. So what they did was they chopped off a branch on their low flying, because we were cutting in between trees and everything else. So we got back to Quang Nai, and then the next day we got another flight, and this time he decided to fly around 3,000 foot altitude, which got us down to Duc Pho. Now, the way they fly over there is generally 3,000 foot altitude is safe enough from small arms, and generally high enough from 50 caliber fire so that you can evade 50s if they start shooting at you. But it's way out of the range of small arms. When you get, 1,500 feet is about the minimum that you go down for small arms. Anything below there and the VC will shoot at you. Well, we got to Duc Pho. We made a spiral descent. What you got to do is you get up and you just about spiral in real steep-like to get down to Duc Pho. And this was a little perimeter, and they had a ranger battalion in there. No, correction, they had an infantry battalion in there in Duc Pho, and this is where the two howitzers were. And then they had up on a hill nearby, they had a ranger company. And then operating in the area, they had another force. And we inspected the weapons there, and they were quite well dug in, and they were just repairing their position because they had a VC attack a few days before. And they still had about a dozen or more VC prisoners that they had captured in one of these underground bunkers nearby. They were tipped off by somebody, and they went out scooping them up. They were using them to repair the defenses and everything else, setting up the barbed wire. And most, I took a couple of pictures of them. I remember most of them were pretty cheerful, with the exception of one, which is a pretty surly individual, but the rest of them didn't seem to mind their being captive at all. We checked the weapons positions. In fact, we fired a mission at a top of a hill mass a couple of miles away. It was a VC radio position. We could see the antenna through binoculars, and we tried to knock the antenna down. But the Vietnamese only fired about 5 rounds, and it was time fire. Their system of fire direction in no way approaches our fire direction. They don't bother. They just, computing and everything, it didn't seem like, as they get in a position they wouldn't even think of using survey or metro. It'd be completely out of the question. They're not that fine with it. But they'd lay the battery. It seems like they could do that, and they had their aiming stakes out at 2,800 mils, and they'd fire. And it seemed like they were in these positions so long that they didn't have to do any computing. They just made their corrections direct on the guns, because they could observe, at least they could observe this antenna from the gun position. I was watching where the rounds were going through binoculars. They fired about 5 rounds just to harass, and then they quit. And I don't know why. I couldn't quite get across to them, they couldn't get across to me as to why they didn't try and destroy the VC antenna, but I guess they just felt that the VC just put up another one, and they didn't have the ammunition to pop away at it.
In other words, sir, they weren't very accurate, or they just deliberately fired that way.
Well, it wasn't that they weren't very accurate. They bracketed the blasted antenna, and this was a time fire. It was just that they didn't appear to want to waste any more rounds than they fired on it. In their own way, they can put the artillery out. They're not as accurate as we are by any means, but in their own way, they can get the rounds out, and they get them out in a hurry. It's just that they don't. They've got all their stuff pre-computed in one of these areas because they've been there a long time, so they just don't bother going over. They just call in the dope and do it, and they don't do any daily registration or anything like that. It's not as fine a job as I'd like to call it. Well, we had some Vietnamese chow there, normally cold rice and fish and things of that nature. Eggs, they always... don't know how old the eggs were, but their meals are not very sanitary to our standards, and it's just a normal thing that after you eat with the Vietnamese, you figure you're going to get diarrhea or something else a day, that night, or the next day, or something like that, which I did, but this is, you just got used to, that's all it was to it. Because they just rinse their stuff out. They don't use soap and water to wash their bowls out or wash their chopsticks off or anything like that. So we got the chopper out of there and flew back to Quang Nai. And then the next day, we made a motor convoy to a place called Ba Gia, where they had another platoon. Now, this was about 25 kilometers west-northwest of Quang Nai. And I asked the Vietnamese commander there, Captain Na, whether this was safe, and he said yes, it was. And what we had to do was get across the river there, and we had to use a pontoon raft to get our vehicles across. And of course, I insisted that we take a radio along so we'd have some sort of communications with the artillery people as we were going in, and some system of calling for help if we got ambushed along the way, since there hadn't been too many people using this road for a long time prior to this. He wasn't going to take a radio at first until I insisted on it, and then he decided to take one. And we also had a weapons carrier with about a squad of men and a couple of BARs as some extra protection. We finally got across the river there on the pontoon float, formed up our little convoy. I think there was about six or seven vehicles in it. I was accompanied by a Captain Clarence Dilworth, USMC, who was also an artillery battalion advisor. He was a 4 Deuce Battalion Advisor. They were phasing out the 4.2-inch mortar battalions, and he was going along because he just wanted something to do. We were armed with M1 carbines at the time, and I rode with Captain Na, and the roads were very, very bad, and they had been cut many times by the VC. The VC cut these roads, they cut ditches in them, and they make it so that only a person on a bicycle or a person walking can get through the roads. Well, some of these had been filled in again, and we went along this road. This is just after the enormous floods that they had in about November 10th, 11th, or 12th, or something like that, of 64. And there was quite a bit of destruction in the villages. We saw a lot of dead animals, bloated, laying in the paddies, and they were just picking themselves up together. They were in pretty sad shape. A lot of these thatched huts were completely destroyed. Along this road, there were many, many excellent positions where if anybody wanted to ambush us, I'd say a platoon would have been a good enough size. They could have just wiped us out because we didn't have any air cover. We requested it. We couldn't get it. It was just one of those things that you got to do a job and you can't get the gear to do it. You got to make up your mind as to whether you're going to do it or you just sit back and wait until everything is completely favorable in your vein. So we decided to go. We got out to Baja. We inspected the two, they had an infantry battalion there, and we inspected the two 105 gun positions. We weren't too satisfied with, they weren't properly dug in. They had too much ammunition broken out of their containers. Captain Na very effectively got the people that were the artillery people there and gave them a good talking to, and we said hello to the infantry battalion commander that was out there, and then he gave us a little bit of an escort back along the road to a position where there was a mountain there. It was just an outstanding spot for an ambush, and he said the VC were up there, but the chances are that they're too busy gathering themselves together and recovering from the flood that they probably wouldn't hit us. We'd passed it before and we had no problem, but we knew now that they knew we went in there by road and that we'd be coming back out again, and it was about a 20-kilometer trip. So we started out about 3 o'clock in the afternoon with this little extra support up to this mountain, and we got through all right. We didn't get ambushed at all, although there were many places where we could have, and it was just one of those things. We were lucky, I guess. We got back and got back to Quang Ngai. And then went back to, got a hop the next day back to Da Nang in the, I think it was a helicopter. Now that's an idea of, that gives you an idea of what the artillery battalion advisor did. He couldn't do much else than that. He couldn't say, all right, why don't we get these two guns out of here and put them in another town, because he had no control over it whatsoever. It was the local infantry battalion commander that these two guns belonged to, and he employed them as such. Generally, before some of these artillery tubes could fire, they had to have the approval of the district chief, the Vietnamese district chief in the area, because he got into the chain of command. And sometimes the district chief was a military commander also. Sometimes he was a civilian. It just was one of these situations. It was very peculiar. But another thing that I did was I got a hold of, I thought that the one thing that they needed was better dug-in 105 positions. So I prepared a diagram showing them how they could sandbag in their positions, make a place for their ammunition and a place for their people to sleep, how to, where to dig foxholes and how to build this parapet up, and how to build a little bunk room off to one side and have a burster plate in there so that they couldn't be fired upon and destroyed, and that, you know, and at the same time have a clearer field of fire where the 105s could fire direct fire. I got all this, I made a stencil up, and I got this thing, the definitions of it all translated into Vietnamese, and I typed this all in the Vietnamese on a stencil, and I had about 100 of them run off, and I gave them the Captain Na, and he went and put these things out, I hope, and you never knew. Well, shortly thereafter, I found out that I was going to be transferred down to Rung Sat Special Zone, which is a zone south of Saigon. And in this, because they needed a Marine captain down there, and I had no idea what the job was, but I was the one that was selected because they knew they had Marine officers up in the First Corps. So about the 1st of December, I got my orders to report on down to, fly on down to Saigon and report into the Naval Advisory Group for further employment in Rung Sat Special Zone. So on the 3rd of December, I got an aircraft out, a C-123, and flew on down to Saigon, Tansanut Airport, where I found the Naval Advisory Group, and I reported in there. And I reported into a Marine Major Edward J. Bronars, USMC, who was the senior advisor for Rung Sat Special Zone.